Calcio Land Podcast with David Amoyal.
Benvenuti, as we would say in Italy. Welcome to all of you that don't speak Italian. Thank you so much for joining us for the Friday episode of the Calcio Land Podcast. So today we have a great show planned for you. At the top, we'll recap a little bit the Euro. I know it's been 5 days since the final, so we'll take a look at, kind of some late thoughts on what transpired there. We'll, of course, cover Donnarumma's official move to PSG now being completed. And we'll talk a little bit about some hot transfer topics that we've seen in Serie A recently. We, of course, have a part of the podcast just for patrons. And then at the end, you'll hear, everyone will be able to hear a part of the interview I did recently with Napoli Outsider, who comes on once a month on Patreon to chat about, various topics. And we covered a lot Italy, so you hear his perspective there. So I'm very curious. I haven't spoken. I texted Alex here or there, but we haven't done a pod since the Friday final. So I want to ask you this, Alex. I know, obviously, you're very invested. You're friendly with some of the players on England. Chelsea was represented on England, also on Italy. But let me ask you this. What do you make about Italy winning the Euro, and how will you remember this particular team?
Well, as a Chelsea fan, how will I remember it? Jorginho, Emerson. Meaning, obviously, all Chelsea fans are happy for Jorginho and Emerson. And Jorginho, I'll mention a bit more than Emerson. No offense, Emerson. Once upon a time, you and I were tight. Justice for Emerson. But there is definitely, David, and this is no surprise to you, a certain cult in the Chelsea fan base that almost support Jorginho more than Chelsea. And Jorginho was everywhere. Ballon d'Or tweets every 5 seconds. And hey, I would love for a Chelsea player to win, so I'm down for it. But yeah, I think 10 years time, as a Chelsea fan, it's hard to even remember the Chiesas and the Spinazzolas and the Donnarummas and the Insignes, because when Sarri came to Chelsea, something crazy happened in the Chelsea fan base where it became like fans of the English players and English managers versus everyone else. And I hope for better times and easier times and smoother times. But in all seriousness, this Itzuri team, I'll always remember, David. We said it throughout the tournament. I know I said it on here and many platforms. I'll always remember that Italy looked like the club team, and then everybody else looked like an international team. And that's not a bad thing, the latter, that the other teams look like international teams, because newsflash, they are. They are international teams. So are Italy, of course. But from the get-go, and yeah, I know Italy started off the tournament against Turkey, who may have been the worst of the worst in the tournament, but still, right from the get-go, fluid football. Football where it almost felt, I'm not saying it was exactly Sarri's Napoli's football, but it almost felt like that football where if the players closed their eyes, they knew where their teammates were. And that's just very, very hard with international football, because you just don't have much time with each other to work on these things. And the amazing contrast, David, to get to the final is England, if you look at some stats, you can argue they deserve to be there as well, because they beat Croatia and they beat Germany, and in the whole tournament, they allowed 2 goals. The whole tournament, they allowed 2 goals. And one of them was an absurd free kick from Damsgaard for Denmark. So they only allowed 1 in open play. And the 1 goal England allowed from open play was obviously against Italy. And it happened right in front of net, almost like a freak thing. So England deserved to be in the final. But the stark contrast is Italy played kind of club football. And I just explained what I mean by that. England played the definition of tournament football. The definition, meaning, yeah, we're going to play it safe. We are going to play it safe. At the end of the day, we just don't want to be a team you can score against. And the irony, David, to make a parallel, is what many Jorginho doubters have held against him, that whole narrative, oh, he just passes it from side to side, he does nothing else. The irony is, Italy didn't really do that. England did. That was England's game plan. Pass it from side to side. And I truly believe it was actually their game plan. Pass it from side to side. And when a winger like a Sterling or a Saka or maybe Kane, if he shows up deeper forward on the side, if there's some space, that's when you penetrate and go. But England's game plan was pretty clear. Hold tight, make sure you're not scored against, and when you can, try and find those goals. So I just love the parallel because you had a arguable club team versus a international team. And the guy who gets blamed for passing it sideways was not really doing that as much as the team that they faced in the final. But at the end of the day, yeah, David, I mean, I'll just remember it as one of the more impressive team performances I've seen from an international team in a long time. I mean, think about it. I know Donnarumma and Jorginho and obviously some others like Spinazzola are easy shouts for maybe the star player for Italy. But how many players can you shout? You can shout so many damn players. Insigne, Chiesa, obviously the center backs, Di Lorenzo, Verratti, Locatelli to start the tournament. So I will remember it as just an incredible team performance from a country. And sometimes that's very hard. Sometimes you do have to have some superstars pick you up. So yeah, that's exactly how I'll remember it, David. I'm wondering, what were some of your key takeaways now that we're about 4.5 days later?
Yeah, so I definitely like how you put it, that this Italy really, it would be a great club team. And I actually have been wondering, you know, if you pluck in this Italy team in Serie A as is, you know, how they would do. It would be very interesting. So I have a lot of thoughts on this, but I'm going to try to cover maybe some things that you haven't heard in a lot of other places. So I have a lot of thoughts on the final game, but I will say the shootout itself at the end really reminded me a lot about the penalty shootout in the 1990 World Cup, which Italy was hosting at home in Italy when they lost to Argentina in 1990 to Maradona. I see a ton of parallels. England was the host. They had a great team. A lot of people really thought they were going to win. I think back then in Italy, a lot of people felt the same way about that team in 1990. It's 1-1, goes to penalty kicks, and then Argentina wins the penalty shootout fairly decisively. So I felt going into that penalty shootout that it was 1990 all over again, but this time tables were reversed for Italy. And the other thing, look, we know England has a dreadful record with penalty shootouts, but it wasn't that long ago that Italy was kind of the same. So this, I feel like the tide turned when Italy won in the 2006 World Cup. The other thing, as you said, this is a great group of players. Historically, the Italy teams that have won or gone to finals of tournaments had, you know, blocks of teams, usually the Juve block. In the 90s, we had the Inter block, not the case here. Plenty of teams represented. And I think that is also one of the reasons why so many people latched on to this team. I think, too, from a social media perspective, what's very interesting is you probably saw a lot of, you know, fans that may be of different teams in Serie A that normally clash with one another that were kind of all on the same team this time. And I think it was easier because so many teams were represented there. The other thing that I'm very happy is I want to single out a couple of players and personnel. Now, I know a lot was made about Mancini, Vialli, even Ivani, who was on the sidelines when Italy looking very dapper. He was a former Milan player, but maybe the one that needs to be talked to a little bit more is Beppe Orreale, who is the team manager both for Italy and Inter. And the team manager is really kind of the liaison between the players and the managers, directors, and whatnot. So Orreale has had really a great stretch between Inter winning the Scudetto and Italy winning just now the Euro. So big shout out to him. And then I want to give a shout out to Chiellini and Bonucci, which obviously is pretty easy now. Look, a lot of non-Juve fans, you know, have pointed out these guys have won nothing outside of Italy. Look at their track record in the Champions League. Well, I would say, hey, you know, they did make some finals, which is better than players that didn't, but they had never won a trophy outside of Italy. So good for them. You guys know I'm a huge Chiellini guy. I was very happy to see so many people kind of learn more about what a great guy Chiellini is off the pitch. And I think people really saw it with his demeanor in so many of the games, the way he carried himself even after they won with the Astori tribute when Italy won. So good for him. Bonucci, look, you know, I think he's always going to be one of those guys that for different reasons people don't like. But look, you know, I've said it before, it's similar to Materazzi. There are players that you hate when they are an opponent, but then you have them on your team for a little while and you're like, huh, it's just kind of nice to have this guy. He may be a jerk, but, you know, guess what? He's my jerk here. So that's that. And then I want to close on Donnarumma, which will be kind of a segue of what we're talking here. Look, you know, a ton has been made since Sunday, very unfortunately, on the players on England being abused, which sadly, and I thought Saka said it best, that he knew the minute he missed exactly what was going to happen. So the fact that he knew what was coming, I think, is really depressing in and of itself. But I'm going to say this. And I'm not just saying it to, you know, sound like, you know, like I have great values and all. They are not the reason England lost the game. England had a home game for the final. It was 120 minutes. Donnarumma made double the amount of saves in the penalty shootout that he did in the entire game. I think he made one save the whole game. Shaw scored, and then he made one save. And that was it. Then in the penalty shootout, he saved two. It was a home game for England, 120 minutes. That's why England lost. It's not because they missed the penalty kicks. They should have won the game before. I think in a lot of ways, scoring that early goal maybe wasn't the greatest thing, but they've been playing kind of in this way the whole tournament. And then I would add that look at the offensive talent they had going into the penalty shootout. You know, before those guys came in, and ask yourself, how many of the Grealish, Sancho, how many of these guys could Serie A teams afford? I would say none right now. And these guys were on the bench watching England make no shots on goal during the whole game. So listen, I feel terrible for the three players that were abused, but in my book, they are not the reason England lost. They lost because Donnarumma made double the amount of saves in the shootout. So those are my thoughts on this.
Yeah. Quickly, would you also agree, and I'm not saying you didn't already say this just in general, but I think they also lost because, David, when England scored super early, I actually thought that was bad. I know that sounds so ridiculous, but be careful of early goals. Now, I'm not saying if you were to freeze time and say, Alex, would you like England or whatever team you're rooting for to score early? Of course, I would say yes. Like, I'm going to take the goal. Duh. But, man, I feel like if Italy had scored early, they would have known how to actually deal with that opposed to England. England, like I said, they played tournament football, which means they played it safe throughout the tournament. So once they scored, they tried to play it safe for about 90 minutes. And that is not going to work. The Azzurri are too good. They're too good. So that's a bit of the downfall, I think, of Gareth Southgate. But by the way, I completely agree. England did not lose because those guys missed penalty kicks. I mean, Donnarumma is incredible. And just look at the resolve of the Azzurri. Like, I think that Spain game really prepped them to be down to England, if you know what I mean. Because
absolutely,
we're doing so well before Spain. And then Spain kind of reminded them, you're not invisible. Like, you're not, you know, flawless here. But Italy rebounded so well in that game against Spain. I mean, I understand it went to penalties, but still, they rebounded. So once England scored early, Italy knew how to deal with that. And England, conversely, didn't know how to deal with scoring early. So, yeah, I thought that was really
Without a doubt. So let's talk a little bit more about Donnarumma. I did a column for our patrons where, you know, I wrote about the players whose transfer value on the Azzurri went up. And look, he left on a Bosman, but I think it's undeniable that Donnarumma's worth more after this amazing tournament that we had. But you're much more, you know, familiar with other leagues than I am. You know, for me, it's very hard to gauge Donnarumma versus current competition. I can tell you right now, historically, I think Donnarumma has the opportunity to really go down as a great all-time. But let me ask you this, Alex, right now, in the game right now, if you know, if a game, your whole life was on the line in one game, how many keepers would you rather have over Donnarumma right now?
Oh, wow. I'm just trying to think if there's anybody, honestly. Like, you know, we're talking about just overall form, like who's up as the best. I'll even be cheeky and I'll even throw in Mendy from Chelsea. I could throw in Neuer, who's really rebounded. I got
Oblak would maybe be the guy on Atletico, the only one, right?
I always forget about Oblak because, David, I got to be honest, I forget about Atletico Madrid in general. They're that team that you always just forget exists because they play, in my opinion, a dreadfully boring style of football. And to their credit, they're such a team. You know, Simeone's got his own thing going on. But no, Oblak is no doubt one of the top keepers. He's a top three keeper in the world for sure. But, you know, to answer your question the way you asked it, would I really want anyone for one game over Donnarumma after seeing the final? No. If you had asked me it before the Euros, I would have thrown him in a basket with the other guys we just kind of mentioned. But after watching him in a tournament and then a final, and you just phrased the question as one game, how could I really say anybody? Because he's got the great combination and obviously being just a ridiculously talented keeper. But now we know he can handle the pressure. So my big thing, and it's not a hot take, is, oh, you got talent? That's nice. What's your mentality like? Well, Donnarumma just shoved it in the face of England and pretty much every fan out there. He showed you his mentality. So, nah, I wouldn't take anybody over Donnarumma for one game. And what does that say about him, considering how young he is? That says a lot. Because normally, David, you ask me that question like verbatim for any sport, and you would just say, like, what small forward, what center, what pitcher in baseball? I would probably always side if it was really up in the air with the more experienced guy, you know, because they've just been in that situation more. So if it's one game, I'd probably side with the veteran, the senior player. But nah, Donnarumma, I mean, first of all, he's already been playing for ages anyway, despite the young age. So nah, I mean, you know, it honestly is about time we probably start talking about Donnarumma as one of the best players in the world. But keepers don't really get that love, do they? They don't really get thrown into the best player category. They almost get their own category, which I guess is nice. But at the same time, if you're that good like Donnarumma is, maybe you should be getting shouts for just best player. So, yeah, I'm not saying he's the absolute best. But no, to answer your question, I wouldn't take anyone over Donnarumma at this point. So, yeah. And maybe that perfectly segues into what I want to ask you now. What do you make of his transfer now that it is official and that you know he's going to be the PSG keeper? And I saw some graphic, like, PSG still owns like eight other keepers or something like that.
Yeah, no, it's crazy. And look, one last thing I would add to what we were saying on Donnarumma, I think the fact that he didn't even know that his save ended the Euro and that Italy won, in a way, it makes me like him more, because I think this is a guy who will not suffer pressure because he's just kind of like oblivious. And I say that as a positive. You know, on one hand, you'd be like, oh, you want players to really be aware. But listen, the guy felt like I thought he was trying to be like super cool about the celebration and be above it. But it was like he literally didn't know. And I think in a way, maybe it's because he won that we're spinning it as a positive. So as far as the transfer, look, you know, we talked about Italy, I thought was the best team at the Euro. I thought they deserved, but I think Serie A was the best league at the Euro in general. I thought the league carried itself really well, but sadly, we've seen, you know, Donnarumma leave, and Hakimi and Depaul weren't part of, you know, the Euro, but these are two other players whose transfers out of Serie A are official. And these are really tough blows because, look, you know, I think almost everyone, if they did the team of the season for the campaign that just ended, I think pretty much everyone has those three in the starting lineup, and now they're all gone. So that's a problem. But I would say the silver lining for Serie A is we saw the various Gosens, Mele, Damsgaard, like, really stand out. Like, we know Serie A is great at discovering these talents. Let's hope, though, that there's going to be more ability to retain them. So a couple more thoughts on Donnarumma. And these are, you know, I always like interacting with people on Twitter and sometimes listening to different opinions because it kind of makes me think things through. So a couple of things that were raised.
That Juve is going to really regret not signing Donnarumma, possible. And I saw some people say, you know, if only Szczesny had left, if only there was a market for Szczesny. I'm going to say this. I think even had Juve been able to sell Szczesny for a big plus Valenza at the age of 31, not coming off a good season, and I'm a big fan of his, I'm going to say, let's even say Juve makes a big plus Valenza on Szczesny of Premier League clubs, like, you know what? I'm going to take him off your hands. I still don't think Juve was going to come close to matching that salary. And I say, and the reason I say that is that it wasn't long ago that Juve asked all their players to take a pay cut of 2 months. So, you know, about a 15% pay cut. I think it's very tough to then turn around and welcome in a player who would be your second highest paid player after Ronaldo and say, well, thank you guys for taking a pay cut. You should be glad because we'll have Donnarumma now for 12 years. We know we're paying him a lot. Tough ass that you guys took a pay cut. I think that was always going to be tough. So I don't think Juve fans should have much regret. For Milan fans, and I've said this before, but I think it's even more important to look at it this way. There's really two ways to look at Donnarumma leaving. The positive angle. It was an enormous cost to maintain him. So at what PSG is paying him, Donnarumma costs you over 20 million a season just in wages because it's 12 million net. So you're talking 20 million just in wages every year. On top of that, you have to add the commission to Raiola. So we're looking at the first year, potentially Donnarumma costing you upward of 35 million. Mañan, even although they paid 15 million in the transfer fee because his wages are so low, about 2.5%, he's costing you about 8 million a year. So the important thing here for Milan is you can say, look, even if Mañan has a great season, odds are he is going to be a downgrade from Donnarumma. But if you reinvest those savings of what you saved by not paying Donnarumma, there is a world in which Milan is even actually better without him because of that enormous cost. So that's the positive. And at the end of the day, our opinions, everything that we say, what's going to matter is Milan going to be consistently a top four team? If they do it, then they survived not losing Donnarumma, for free, and hopefully they also get a trophy in the next few years. The flip side, though, the more negative sign is yesterday Di Marzio rightfully pointed out that Milan deserves a lot of credit because in a very difficult time on the transfer market, they've spent 60 million, which is true. But let's ask ourselves, after spending 60 million, would you say that Milan's better today than they were when the season ended? I would say no. And it seems people are in agreement. I saw yesterday odds makers in Italy put out the odds right now for teams to win the Scudetto. Milan was fourth. They finished second. So this is what a lot of people think. So they spent all this money. They spent all this money to keep Tomori, which was great, Tonali, and replace Donnarumma mainly. They got Giroud, which I think is a great signing. So you've spent almost all the money that you're getting for going to the Champions League to retain the players that you already had. In an ideal world, I think we'd all say, oh, you're the team that spent the most so far. You would want to think that the team got better. I'm not sure we can really say this with Milan. And to me, this all goes back to the fact that no Serie A team can afford to lose multiple starters for nothing. Eventually, it just catches up to you because then you try to replace those guys with players on loan sometimes. And then if they do well enough and you want to buy them, like Tomori, great deal. Very good job by Maldini and Massara negotiating that option to buy. But again, you gave up a lot of that money that you made from going to the Champions League for it. So I think long and short of it, and we'll get to it later in the hot transfer topics, the takeaway for Milan is with Kessi, Romagnoli, Kier, three players that have expiring contracts next year. In my mind, you can't start the season with their contracts still expired. Either you renew or you sell them. The bottom line, and you have to replace them with players that you own, because if not, this vicious cycle of kicking the payment down the line sooner or later catches up to you. But I do want to end on this, that there is a world where Milan can be better even without Donnarumma. But the key is, how are they going to spend the money? And if they're going to spend all the money that they're saving by not having him on the squad.
Okay. Good stuff right there. All right, David. Well, that really does overall segue us into talking about transfers further. So let's get to hot transfer topics officially. And this is a pretty sneaky storyline because I like this player. What are the odds that Vlahovic leaves Fiorentina?
Now, Vlahovic is really, really, really good. I have to say, Alex, if your campaign of bringing a Haaland to Chelsea works out, if I was Borussia Dortmund, man, Vlahovic is the guy I would want to replace him. But it might be to the point where now clubs are catching up to this and be like, maybe we should be buying the guys that Dortmund is targeting before. That way we just cut out the middleman. And I think Vlahovic might be getting to this point. So we've heard him linked recently to Spurs. Makes sense. Paratici is running things there. He knows Serie A. Paratici actually did buy Chiesa from Fiorentina, and I suspect it would be a little bit easier to get a top Fiorentina player to go to Spurs as opposed to Juve, because Juve are their bitter rivals. But the other detail that's important is Vlahovic's contract expires in 2023. Fiorentina waited until the last possible second to sell Chiesa, and he was right when his contract was 1 year left. So the equivalent would be next year for Vlahovic for Fiorentina. My guess is they would consider a huge bid, but it would have to be a huge, huge bid. So let's say Kane goes to Man City for an absurd amount, and for about half of that, I would say 60 million. I think every Serie A club, with very few exceptions, would consider offers like that for some of their top players. I would hate to see Vlahovic leave Serie A, but man, that guy is really, really good. So I'm going to say Fiorentina will likely try to do all they can, hold on to him the way they did with Chiesa. But I do think they would also consider an offer they can't refuse. And then it would be very interesting to see how they would go about replacing him.
Interesting. Good point there on, well, if we can get a sniff of who Dortmund wants before they get them, maybe get them before Dortmund. But then again, it's a good idea. And I know you also meant it as a bit of a joke. They clearly do an immense job at developing some of these guys as well. All right.
Let's get
to this one, David. Do you think Luis Alberto will stay at Lazio?
I really hope so. I really want him to see play for Sarri. So for those of you not familiar with the situation, when Lazio's retreat started, Luis Alberto didn't show up. He did report yesterday. We're recording this Friday afternoon, supposedly met with Sarri. So he's there now. He is looking to be paid at the rate Immobile and Milinkovic-Savic are. Look, Lazio, in general, keep wages low. Their players at the high end make 4 million net, which is, you know, is a good salary, very good salary for Serie A. Immobile and Milinkovic-Savic are at that. Luis Alberto signed for around 3 million net, but he has a long-term contract till 2025. So let's see if Lazio give him a raise. Does he have a ton of leverage to leave with the long contract? Probably not. But look, you know, if a player wants to go nowadays, odds are it can happen. But look, Lazio will not sell him cheaply, having him under contract for that long. I think it's more considerably more likely than not that he stays at Lazio. But if he does leave, I sadly think this would be pretty similar to DePaul, where literally almost every team in Serie A could use him, but hardly anyone can afford him. I know for Milan, what's been brought up is a potential swap for Romagnoli, which, look, on paper, this makes a lot of sense because Sarri wants to go back to a four-man defense. You could have Acerbi and Romagnoli, two starting center backs. That sounds pretty good to me. We know that although Romagnoli is a former Lazio player, Roma player, he is a Lazio fan. So all that makes sense. But what doesn't make sense to me is that Romagnoli has 1 year left on his deal. His agent is Raiola. If I know anything about Lotito, the idea that he's going to be the one to negotiate with Raiola to give Romagnoli the contract for the prime of his career, because I think he's 26 now. So these are like 26 to 30 are the years typically when players make the most money. But Lotito is going to be the one to pay Raiola what he wants for Romagnoli. I have my doubts. But if you told me on paper, Romagnoli and cash for Luis Alberto, I think Lazio could do a lot worse. But my guess is he would try to sell him abroad and make big money. But I think he ultimately stays at Lazio, and I'm going to get my wish to see him play for Sarri.
Oh, good friend. Sorry. All right. Last topic here, David. What are the odds that Frank Kessié extends his contract with Milan?
Yeah. So as I mentioned, we were talking about Donnarumma. I think it's absolutely imperative, with no exceptions, that the season cannot start with Kessié still not having an extension signed at Milan. Because look at it this way. Milan's going to be in the Champions League. He did really well in the Europa League. Think of how much praise Kessié got for that game at Old Trafford where he was brilliant. Imagine him playing in the Champions League, and he's a great player right now. The showcase he would have on there, then he would get some absurd offers. So Milan, I think Milan have to learn. And look, the other thing that I didn't say about Donnarumma is, look, at first I used to kind of crush Milan for losing him for nothing, but I'm going to crush more Donnarumma now. Donnarumma more for leaving Milan, which he claims to love, and making sure they got nothing for him. Even Icardi at Inter signed an extension before he left to ensure they got a better return. So sorry, I forgot to mention that earlier. But on Kessié, Maldini was asked about it. He said he expects Kessié to be on the team, and they're working out the contract. But again, I don't think the first game of the season can start with Kessié being at Milan with just 1 year left on the deal. They have to figure that out. I think here, almost as important, but Kessié with that age, I mean, you can't lose Çalhanoğlu. Look, we could debate all day how good or not he is, but I think everyone would agree that Kessié and Donnarumma are clear blue chip players that could start, you know, certainly for any team in Serie A at their position. So I think there's a good chance he will extend with Milan. The other caveat with this is, keep in mind, Kessié is going both to the Olympics, and then he'll be playing in the Africa Cup in January. Granted, the Africa Cup also coincides with an international break in Europe, but Bennacer will also be there. So if you're a Milan fan, if you see them linked to Bakayoko, I wouldn't assume that that means that Kessie's leaving. It might be that they just want more depth because they know they're losing two central midfielders in the summer. So I really hope Kessié extends with Milan. I know there's Inter fans that are thinking, maybe we can do Çalhanoğlu 2.0. I don't think that's going to happen. I think if, God forbid, Kessié doesn't extend with Milan, he's going to go to a Premier League team. So let's see what happens there. So before we play the Napoli outsider part that we recorded on the Azzurri, which I think you will really enjoy, we're going to do a part of the podcast for our patrons. If you enjoy Calcioland, consider becoming a patron. I genuinely think the monthly chats with Napoli outsider are worth it in and of itself. We also have some great monthly shows with the great Francesco Calcio as well. We do a Tuesday pod just for patrons, and we answer all your questions. Oh, I'm so excited to welcome the next guest, my dear friend, Napoli Outsider. Been getting great feedback from you guys, patrons, on our shows together. I definitely agree they have been getting better. So if you are a patron, you're going to hear a long chat where we'll cover Italy, the transfer window, talk a little bit about Napoli at the end. If you're a regular listener, you'll hear more the Azzurri part. So my dear friend, it's always a real pleasure to chat with you. Bentornato to Calcioland.
Hi, David, and I'm so happy to be back, especially after this great weekend we just had. So glad to be talking Calcio with you.
For sure. Yeah, no, well, definitely. Let's start with the Azzurri, because last time I had you on was right at the beginning of the tournament, and we were talking about the similarities between Sarri's Napoli and this Nazionale. I think maybe that changed a little bit once Spinazzola got hurt. Maybe we saw a little bit less of that. But I want to start here, and this is actually a tweet that one of our patrons sent me, Amir. And, you know, my tweet originally was like, listen, I don't think we can judge today, like right after the tournament, what Mancini's legacy as an Azzurri coach is going to be. But I think it's certainly going to be excellent. And Amir compared this a little bit to when Deschamps took over France in 2010. For those of you that don't remember, maybe weren't following that closely, that France team completely imploded. There was a mutiny. Domenech, no friend of Italian football, looked really bad. And so basically Deschamps came in from the ground up. Do you agree that there are certain similarities to that?
From that point of view, certainly, yes, because you inherit basically debris, you know, you inherit something that has been destroyed through and through by a terrible coach and you rebuild on it. But there are some differences we really need to point out. For example, the fact that I don't mean to be offensive with the group of players, but Mancini did this with a lot less talent than Deschamps had at his disposal. France have taken out in the last 10 years an amount of talent that's just scary. They could have fielded three teams, literally, at the European Championships, and they would have all been contenders. Whereas, you know, Italy ended up winning, and again, no offense to them, but they finished the final with Bernardeschi, Berardi, and Belotti. So a guy from Sassuolo, a guy from Torino, and a guy from Juventus who never plays. And when he plays, he does poorly, at least for Juventus. So that's the main difference, you know. Deschamps did a really good job, especially in the beginning, not so much, for example, this year. But he did a good job of rebuilding, but he had the material of his availability. Mancini almost built upon nothing, because most of the best players, I would say, except for Chiesa probably, they were already available to Ventura. This is the same group. Maybe Donnarumma also, of course, is young. But, I mean, this is mostly the same group that was already there before. So he just turned the team inside out with his game plan, with his strategy, with his mentality. I mean, but honestly, the league hasn't provided a lot of new material. I mean, sure, we were missing a couple of players, but other than Zaniolo and Pellegrini, we don't really have all that much depth. So Mancini really did a superb job. Again, there are some parallels with Deschamps, but I think you have to note the big difference in talent level that Mancini had to deal with. And I was really incredibly impressed, because to get them to perform well and to keep their game plan intact at all times is really already impressive per se. And I mean, Italy hasn't lost in so many games, 35 games undefeated. I think it was since 2013 that Italy hadn't been this far up in the FIFA world rankings. Right now it's fourth. But I mean, just to see the way Italy were able to do it, even with Belgium, in part with Spain and with England, never losing any composure, even when they were suffering, that was just stunning, stunning, absolutely. I mean, he did such a good job. And one more thing that I would like to point out is, mm-hmm. you know, before Bosman, national teams were considered, well, they were essentially all-star teams of your country. Now, these days, they still are, but they're not even comparable to how good club teams, the top club teams, have become. And leave out the top club teams. Let's talk about a team like Napoli. Last month, you asked me, for example, between Sarri's Napoli and Mancini's Italian national team. And surely there was an inspiration, and I pointed out also the differences. So it's positional football. There is an inspiration from De Zerbi, an inspiration from Sarri, an inspiration from anybody who plays positional football. But then I started to think at the actual comparison between how good each team is. And to be honest, Sarri's Napoli had more talent than this Italian team. And I'm not going to... for me, it did. I mean, I'm not going to
agree.
For example, Barella versus Allan, because, I mean, over a one-month tournament, Barella is good enough to be better than Allan in that 1 month. So I'm not going to nitpick on those, but just the huge ones. for example, the right wing back, Di Lorenzo, actually supplanted Uzai as soon as he got to Napoli. So obviously, the upgrade is huge for the Italian national team, sure. And Donnarumma is an upgrade over Reina, no question. But
yeah,
just
I would
think
say
about the center forward. Mancini, I mean, no offense to Immobile, but Immobile, we discussed this also a few months ago when you asked me if Immobile is so good or so bad. Immobile is really good in a system that works for him and allows him to play vertically. A positional system does nothing for him because he doesn't have the technical skills to do it. And he was the center forward. And when Belotti got in, it almost got worse because Belotti could basically physically fight with other defenders, but he also lacked the necessary technique. Whereas Sarri had at his disposal Higuain, Mertens, or Milik, just to name three guys, which would have all been a huge, immense upgrade. Now, just think about this national team with a center forward, what it could have been able to do. And thinking about the World Cup, I think the simple fact that we could have Zaniolo. Zaniolo is not a natural-born center forward. But in a system like this, he could go Mertens, like Mertens, but a foot taller than Mertens.
Yeah.
He could just be like that. And that would be incredibly exciting. But aside from that, I mean, there are so many comparisons if you look at man-to-man. Obviously, Jorginho was there, and you look at Insigne was there. You look at Chiesa and Callejon, you know.
Yeah.
A lot of teams, like, for example, even Italy started with Berardi over there. So they use a left-footed guy who comes back inside. Once Chiesa started playing on the right, it did look much more like Sarri's Napoli because they had the right winger who was right-footed. Not a lot of teams do that these days. And then Verratti was a bit like Hamsik, although here's another upgrade, for example. In Italy, they were discussing at some point who should play between Verratti and Locatelli, which is absolutely crazy. I mean, I'm going to touch on this a bit later.
Yeah.
Because, I love Locatelli, but I think people don't quite see Verratti every day, and Verratti left so early that I'm not sure they know that how much of a superstar he is. Like, if your life depended on somebody, being fouled and not giving up the ball, after Messi and Neymar, there could be Verratti for me.
Yeah.
Just give him the ball, and he's not going to lose it.
I totally agree.
You got to take him down. Yeah. But the thing is, Verratti is great at short passing, which, of course, works very well in this national team. Then you had Locatelli, who's great at vertical passing. And then you had Pessina, who is fabulous, one of the top five players in the world. Look, this is going to sound outrageous, but he's one of the top five midfielders in the world at playing without the ball. So, like, the way he runs, he makes runs without the ball is incredible. And I don't know of many midfielders who are capable of doing that. Like, a lot of midfielders can do plenty of things better than him. But this one fundamental, I'm not sure there are many midfielders who can do it better. So you had these three guys. But Sarri, at his disposal, had Hamsik, who could do all three things. He was vertical, he scored a boatload of goals with his runs, and he could do short passing. So the fact is, Italy these days, and they're European champions, they're probably not as good as Napoli, which was not, and, you know, I say this as a Napoli fan, it was not one of the top 10 teams in the world at the time. It was probably close, maybe it was like number 9 or 10, something like that. But
yeah,
certainly not as good as Real Madrid or Barcelona or Manchester City or Bayern Munich or even Juventus, unfortunately. So this just gives you an idea of how balance has shifted between national team and club teams. And at the same time, there was the Copa America, and I was looking at it, and I was just shaking my head with Lapadula being the top goal scorer. I mean, you know what I'm trying to say. The thing is, national team football, I had become detached from it. This tournament kind of brought me back in, not just because Italy won, but because of the passions, because of the way,
yeah,
you know, it kind of united people. I think one of the things that contributed was the fact that there wasn't one big feeder team. Like in the past, one thing that really drove me nuts was that they tried, like in the 90s, they tried to make it about Milan. I mean,
yeah,
I guess it was. I mean, the whole defense was Milan. But the fact that you're trying to attach it to a single team, and it detaches it from everybody else. And then there was Ital Juve all of a sudden. Now, this team here had nobody had more than four players. Yeah. And everybody played a part. And it really felt like it was covering the whole of Italy. I mean, if you look at the team, it was like a blend of people from the north, from the center, and from the south, and people playing all over Italy. Like, I mean, I don't remember how many players there were from the south in starting lineup. Like, there was, of course, Insigne, Immobile, Donnarumma. Those are all from Naples. And then you had Berardi, and you had Verratti. You had a bunch of them. And this really looked like a true Italian national team, which is funny because two of the players were Brazilian, but I guess it's the new Italy, and I actually loved it. So it kind of brought me back in. But when we were talking about how good a team it was in terms of individual talent, yes, it falls a little short from with respect to others in the past. And all of this is to say that Roberto Mancini did an incredibly good job. I don't think it can be overstated how good it was. And I don't think it can be overstated how he needs to be assisted at this point. And by that, I mean that I hope somebody pulls off like a couple of center forwards. We might have Moise Keane. We might have Zaniolo, who could be adapted there. And if that happens, then about 15 months from now, I'm going to be really excited about what's going to happen in the Middle East.
For sure. I couldn't agree more. I was going to bring up the fact that there's no block from one team. You mentioned that, you know, it benefited that you had players that were coached by Sarri and De Zerbi. I think that's a great shout, no doubt there. So let's start talking about a few individual players. Let's start with the captain. So I have to tell you, first off, Chiellini was the first person in football that I ever interviewed. So I kind of have I've always liked him a lot as a person, huge fan of him as a guy. I think a lot of people really saw that in this tournament, even what he said about Astori. So great that they saw the personality. But what I want to ask you is what this tournament you think does for his legacy. Because I have to tell you, going into this Euro, you know, I always like to think about great Italian defenders. I kind of saw him in a group with Ciro Ferrara, Vierkovud, players like that, maybe Claudio Gentile.
Riccardo Ferri, those five.
Yeah, both in style and ability. And I think Vierkovud's the most underrated Italian defender. I think Chiellini was right there. In my opinion, with this Euro, and even the thing with Spain with the shootout, I think he's kind of surpassed that tier. I think he's below, obviously, Baresi, Maldini, Scherer, probably Nesta, Cannavaro. I think healthy Nesta maybe beats them all. So how do you see him? Did his performances, did, you know, his personality? And look, you know, narrative, I think, has a lot to do with how we rank players historically. How much of an impact do you think this had on how people are going to remember Chiellini and talk about him even 15, 20 years from now?
I think it's going to have an impact, obviously. For example, Marco Materazzi wasn't as good as him, but winning the World Cup and with him scoring in the final and then scoring a penalty kick, I think that did a lot. Even though, I mean, it didn't change the fact that non-Inter fans kept hating on him, but it did change his status, obviously. And I think it changes with Chiellini as well. The same goes with Bonucci, by the way. Bonucci and Chiellini essentially have been, you know, they've been with Juventus for, I don't know, since 1860 or something like that. So they had always won in the league or within Italy, but they never won abroad. And this was specific to them because, for example, Buffon was a world champion, obviously. So he had won, and he had also won with Parma. He had won the UEFA Cup. So it was about them. They had never won anything internationally, not significant at least, because I think Chiellini won a European championship, an under-19 European championship or something like that. But internationally, they lacked it. So it always felt like, yeah, you're only winning because it's Juventus. And also, they had the misfortune of coming right on the heels of Fabio Cannavaro and Nesta and Maldini. And, I mean, that was an unbelievable generation, which itself was also coming after Costa Curta and Baresi. So, and they were coming after Gentile, Bergomi, Scirea. So basically, since the 70s, Italy always had a bunch of historically great defenders. I think people underrate how much of a run Italy had with defenders. And you could say the same about goalkeepers, of course. They had an incredible run, which was destined to come down. And now Bonucci and Chiellini, obviously, are very good defenders, but as you also said, absolutely, and I agree, they could not be as good as those I mentioned. They were on here right behind. So, for example, like with Riccardo Ferri, with Bjerkovud, with Ferrara, and those players never played as much as they could have or should have because they always had these fiends right on top of them. And a lot of those, like, for example, Baresi was mentioned as the best of his time. Cannavaro, a defender, wins the Golden Ball, obviously. Nesta, another guy. I mean, it's just such a long list. But I think the drop-off, which was inevitable, looked even steeper because they had not won anything. So, and in fact, in a couple of situations, you could point out that they had underperformed or sometimes it was even their fault that Italy went out of other competitions. For example, I think it was Bonucci marking Godin when Godin scored in Uruguay, Italy, and sent Italy out of the World Cup. So, you know, I think this, the fact that they actually won it, and they won it as leaders, and they played great throughout, even though they had to face guys like Lukaku or Kane, and they were never fazed. I think this does a lot for their legacy. At least it shows that even though there was a drop-off from Cannavaro, and, I mean, of course, there had to be, it wasn't as steep as it seemed until now. Now they have legitimated their place in modern Italian soccer history by winning this international title. And I think, you know, especially Chiellini, he actually played on a great role as captain. I got to admit this, man. I mean, I'm not a Juventus fan, as you can imagine, as you know. But I have to say that the tranquility that Chiellini gave to the team, you know, when there was the penalty kick, there were the penalty kicks with Alba, with Jordi Alba.
Yeah, that was it.
And then, you know, when they were booing the anthem, he was just there giving, you know, preaching calm and tranquility to the team, and that came through. I think the only thing he mishandled was the kneeling situation where he said some nonsensical stuff, but it was a situation in which he didn't want to get involved and just said a word salad that meant nothing on one side or the other. That was the only thing he mishandled. From every other point of view, I've got to admit, I mean, he was a really good captain, and he did everything right, really, and what else is there to say? He is a good defender. If we say that he is one of the greatest Italy's ever had, probably not, but only because Italy's had incredible defenders. He's been really good, and probably most other countries he would have been seen in a different light. So this is his moment, and I bet he enjoys it. And in fact, a lot of people didn't want to see him. I mean, for Bonucci, it was different. But the Chiellini, they didn't want to see him. They thought Acerbi or Bastoni could play ahead of him. And I got to say, Mancini stuck to his guns with him and with Verratti, and that was the right call, obviously. It showed. So yeah, I agree with everything you said. I think it does something good for his career. I think it takes him above Bjerkovud and Ferrara, who either didn't play enough, or when they did win something, he was always playing second or third violin to somebody else. In his case, he won it as a captain, and he actually lifted the trophy. And when you do that, it takes you into another dimension, of course.
For sure. Okay, so you briefly mentioned both Materazzi and Bonucci. So let's look at Bonucci, both from the villain and the passing ability. I privately told some friends that, look, the Bonucci thing, his quotes after Italy won, you know, if you don't like English fans and how confident they were going in, maybe Bonucci was the ideal guy to have to play. Because let's be honest, he can be he can rub a lot of people the wrong way, and I think he does it on purpose. So you mentioned Materazzi. To me, you know, I have this saying, I think, you know, some people, when it comes to tournaments like these, I think people, even Materazzi, as you said, non-Inter fans hated that guy, maybe even more than people hate Bonucci now. But in the tournament, he was like, well, he may be an asshole, but he's our asshole this tournament, and I'm going to love him right now. And I think Bonucci's kind of the same. So who do you think was a better villain overall between Bonucci and Materazzi?
I think possibly... Oh, God, this is a tough question, because I think it was Materazzi on an individual level. But because Bonucci has won 9 titles in a row in Serie A, And so he had that to boost himself upon.
Yeah.
I think that made a difference. I mean, the circumstances made a difference. But if we're going by individual personality, I think the personality of Materazzi just made him a supervillain. Materazzi was also, he was also a pretty dirty player, we got to remember.
Yeah.
Bonucci is a guy that rubs you off. He does a lot of trash talking, like a lot of trash talking. Often very uncalled for, by the way. Often he actually starts it because he needs it as a fuel to his own, for his own rage,
he does.
You know, I guess.
He does. So,
but on the field, he's not too dirty. I mean, if you have to look at a dirty defender in Juventus, it's probably Chiellini. Bonucci is a little more, you know, he's more positionally sound. He's more tactically sound. He's not as he's not like Materazzi. He's not going to elbow you when the ref isn't looking. Chiellini might do that, but Bonucci doesn't. That being said, he is probably a better villain just because, you know, Juventus have won a lot, and he has used that to rub people the wrong way, sometimes unnecessarily again. I mean, I think I even understood the fact that he said, you know, 58,000 people are going to shut up tonight, you know, they're going home. And it kind of made me feel good because that was true. But on the other hand, you know, you don't really need to say that. You already won at that point. So, but you see my point. That being said, there are so many parallels between Bonucci and Materazzi. I mean, you think about it. Materazzi was attacked often using his dead mother. There were so many insults to his dead mother, which should have been avoided. Likewise, Bonucci was attacked upon his children. Remember now, one of his children, I don't know how he is now. I hope he's well. But he was basically on the brink of death a few years ago, and he was severely attacked. I mean, that was, both things were really dirty. And they were always considered the second or third best defenders on their own teams, because Bonucci is considered a good defender. But when you think about the tackler, the tough guy, it's Chiellini. I mean, he's also the captain. So, but both of them, what happened was when Italy went down in a huge final, they were the ones who tied it from a corner kick, and then they scored a penalty kick in the lottery, in the penalty kick lottery at the end. So they have this parallel to between them, you know, 15 years apart. I think there's a lot in common. There's also in common that they were ball playing defenders, even though one was right footed, the other one is left footed. And I think they could have actually matched up pretty well together. They're strong in the air, good ball playing center backs from the back. They scored in a major final and contributed to a win. And they are both, you know, rough personality guys that you wouldn't go out. I mean, at least I wouldn't go for a drink with them, definitely. But I admit that, you know, sometimes you need guys like that on your team. I mean, being a Napoli fan, sometimes I really think
you
that
wish you had
part
a guy
of the reason
like
Napoli lost, you know, so many tough games was because they're all such nice guys, you know. And sometimes
100%.
You need that SOB mentality. Somebody who goes in there, I'm not going to say does a tough tackle, but, you know, somebody who's going to do what it takes to win and doesn't just, you know, isn't too shy about certain aspects. So sometimes you need these types of guys. You know, even the Sergio Ramos, you think about all these types of winning guys, they always have another side to them that makes them a little unlikable, because that's what it takes. That's how they're wired, you know. Top athletes are always wired differently, and sometimes it rubs you the wrong way, the way they are wired, but it works for them. And that's the kind of guys Bonucci and Materazzi were. I got to say, between the two, though, I think Bonucci's slightly better. I don't think the gap is as big as many make, because, again, Materazzi had Nesta and Cannavaro ahead of him, and he only played because Nesta got hurt. Bonucci doesn't have those two types, or he would be on the bench as well. That being said, Bonucci has been more consistent for a longer period of time, whereas Materazzi had a few years, but Materazzi had some memorable years too. So I think you make a really good comp, actually, from that point of view. They're the type of villains that you love to hate.
Yeah. Yeah, and look, I don't think Italy wins the World Cup in 2006 without Materazzi, as great as Nesta was. So real fast, last thing on Bonucci. I have to say, when I think of like Italian defenders and defenders I've watched in Serie A, it's really hard to find players that are, you know,
comparable to him passing wise. Like Nesta was pretty good, Baresi was pretty good. I remember Minotti at Parma.
Yeah, very good. Minotti and Grun. Parma had two of them.
Maybe is the one that reminds me the most, but is there, do you consider Bonucci head and shoulders among almost any defender you've watched, at least in his passing ability?
Now, we got to make some qualifying. I got to be precise. Now, first of all, we eliminate wingbacks. We're only talking about central defenders, right?
Correct. Only central defenders, yeah.
And we are only talking about guys who played their whole career as central defenders. Because, for example, also, we're talking about guys in Serie A. Because abroad, you know, for example, guys like Javi Martinez or David Alaba, they have played as central defenders in Bayern Munich, but they have the feet of a midfielder. Why? Because they are midfielders who have been placed in defense to improve ball circulation. But those guys obviously are better passers than Bonucci. But Bonucci, unlike them, was brought up as a defender. Now, I remember, for example, Raul Albiol, another guy who started as a midfielder. But for me, the best ball-playing center-back in Serie A was Sinisa Mihajlovic. Mihajlovic could do whatever he wanted with his left foot.
Great job.
I remember Mihajlovic and Vieri. That connection at Lazio was absolutely unbelievable. I saw so many goals scored the same way. Mihajlovic launches a ball from his own defense to Vieri. Vieri chests it down. He gets fouled. Mihajlovic goes, takes the free kick and scores. It was just like a system. You know, that's the way we're going to play. We're just going to have those two guys do their thing. And Mihajlovic was absolutely unbelievable. But then again, Mihajlovic is another guy who started as a midfielder, as a left back. He played all over, and then he settled as a center back. If we're going to go only by center backs, I think Bonucci is probably, you know, in a tier with probably Baresi, and I would say slightly below Thiago Silva. For example, Thiago Silva was a phenomenal passer. There's one difference if you really like Bonucci. Bonucci has a better long ball.
Yeah,
Thiago Silva was fabulous at playing short passes, but Bonucci is probably, out of the guys who were brought up as central defenders, the guy with the best long ball. Now, we're talking about Serie A, because if we're going to go outside of Serie A,
you can give us a few names outside, but yeah, I agree. Give us a few outside.
You know, these days, a lot of managers have a central midfielder drop between the two defenders to start the play. But, for example, Johan Cruyff at Barcelona had Ronald Koeman play as a central defender and step up into midfield to organize play. And Rambo Koeman was probably the best defensive passer that I remember. And obviously, I didn't live through the era of Ruud Krol. I didn't live through the era of Beckenbauer. And I didn't really see Shirea either. So those guys, I mean, we're going with the players I saw at least as a kid, but guys like that, or for example, there was a Brazilian called André Cruz. I'm sure you remember about him.
Yeah.
And he was basically like Mihajlovic himself. He also took free kicks. He had a sensational left foot. You know, Bonucci could fit right in there with those guys. Once you eliminate the guys who were natural midfielders and move back into the defensive line, I think Baresi, Thiago Silva, and that's pretty much it. Maybe Materazzi himself, actually. He had a really good ball and was a good passer. And, I mean, a guy, for example, you have these days guys like Skriniar, or Napoli had Albiol just a couple of years ago. But, again, those guys started out as midfielders. And that's a tendency that's taking place these days. If you have a good midfielder with a really good body, he ends up playing on defense usually, because these days it's not so much about tackling, but it's about positioning and building the play from behind. So having a guy who doesn't really tackle, but is really good at positioning and playing the ball, that really works. Now, these days, Bonucci himself has De Ligt right next to him, and he might be as good as, or better than him in the coming years in terms of passing the ball. But I got to say, yes, Bonucci deserves to be mentioned among the best. Now, if he's the best, I would still take Thiago Silva, But yeah, I mean, it's worth talking about his name too.
For sure. Okay, just one more Juve player you have to praise. So just bear with me. We have one more to get through. So let's talk about Chiesa, who I thought was really sensational this year. Oh, look, there's
I thought you were
going
to mention Bernardeschi. You were a player that you had to praise.
We could. But let's stick on Chiesa. And I have to say, look, I've said it many times. There's no player that I've changed. Locatelli being second that I've changed my mind more on. I mean, when I used to watch Chiesa at Fiorentina, he was so disinterested. His body language was awful. I was like, I really don't get the hype on this guy, but he was great at Juve. I thought he was sensational this Euro. So let me ask you these two questions on him. Do you think Chiesa is going to end up being a better Juve player than Dybala? And I think Dybala for a while, and his story is not over yet, had some great season as Juve. And would you say he's the best bet for an Italian player to win the Euro? And I'll go with the caveat beyond this year, because we might have one this year, which is an out of the question. So I'm going to say after this year, would you say Chiesa is the best bet for an Italian player to win the Ballon d'Or?
So you want me to start from the last one? I'll say no. I'll say no because the Golden Ball, the Ballon d'Or, always goes to, well, usually goes to somebody who scores a lot of goals, especially if he's forward. Now, it is probably the best chance for an Italian in the sense that we don't have a great goal scorer. So Insigne is already 30, and you look at the offensive line, Insigne is already 30, and Bernardeschi, Berardi, Politano, Raspadori, Immobile, Belotti, all these guys have no match. So in that sense, Chiesa probably offers the best chance, but the chance is still very minimal, in my opinion, because he just doesn't score enough goals. I mean, it would be surprising for me to find him in the top 20 of the Ballon d'Or, unless he becomes a goal scorer, which has happened to some, to some wingers. But with all the running he does, he doesn't strike me as a guy that's going to score 25 or more each season, which is what he would really need to match up with the guys who do win the Ballon d'Or. Now, there are other types of guys who also win it, but the other guys are the guys who are leading teams that basically win the Champions League and win the World Cup and win the European Championship. So in that sense, a lot of people made Jorginho's name. Jorginho is not going to win it because he doesn't have the star power to his name, even though he's an incredibly underrated player.
And I think missing that penalty took out any chance he had. Had he scored the game-winning, maybe as an outside shot, but I think that took it. I thought that ended that narrative.
Probably you're right. I mean, he already doesn't have too many fans because he's not a guy that does the highlight kind of stuff. You know, when people watch highlights instead of watching a game, which seems to be the case these days, people don't know how to watch a soccer game anymore. They watch a lot of highlights. He's not there because he's the guy who gives the start to the play and then not the finish. So he's usually not the guy who assists or scores. He's the guy who intercepts the ball, who gives the tempo to the team, who organizes the team and makes others play well. But he's not the guy who ends up in the highlights or ends up in the box scores. So he's probably not going to win it. And even though, you know, he probably should have a chance because in my opinion, he's one of the top three or five midfielders in the world these days. And it's no chance that he's won the Europa League, he's won the Champions League, and he's won the European Championship, always as an underrated contributor. But if we should look at an Italian, I think you should look at Donnarumma. I mean, he was unbelievable in the end. He's going to go play for Paris Saint-Germain. He's going to be, I think, he's going to be the highest-waged goalkeeper in the world. And he's 22, and he's everybody's hero, essentially, these days, except for Milan fans, of course, but that's another reason. In terms of performances, I think only Jan Oblak, right now, could stand up next to him. But Oblak, obviously, doesn't have the national team to support him. So if you're really looking at someone, that's a pick out of the box. And that could work, and the reason is, if you're going with a forward, and I think Messi's going to win this year because obviously he's won the Copa America. He absolutely dominated the Copa America. That was his first major win with an Argentina shirt. So he just got an excuse to get another Ballon d'Or, and he's going to win it. But if you don't go with a forward, you're never going to go with Chiesa anyway because Chiesa, he is also a forward. He's a winger, but he's a forward. if you go with somebody else, then it's probably going to be Donnarumma, because nobody's going to argue about the fact that he doesn't score. And he's got plenty of highlights in which he saves the day for Milan or for the Italian national team. So I think if you're looking at the best chance right now, it's probably him, and for the foreseeable future. Because Verratti is a great player, but again, he's got the Jorginho syndrome where he doesn't end up in the highlights. And Keane is a good player, but he's not that good. Chiesa, again, same situation. And who knows, if Zaniolo comes back stronger, maybe, and he converts into a center forward and scores a lot of goals in this Mancini system, maybe. But again, the only one I see is Donnarumma if they go with a non-forward. Because in my opinion, I mean, he could really deserve it. If I look at the rest of the national team, nobody's got the star power. He does.
Agreed. What about Chiesa long-term at Juve versus Dybala? Sure. You think five years from now, people will look and say Chiesa was the better player at Juve?
You know, you said one interesting thing. You said that he was looking uninterested and indifferent at Fiorentina. And young players sometimes do that. And it's tough to understand who does that, because he's demotivated and just needs to be challenged, like Chiesa, and then blossoms into a new environment. And who is just like that, period, like Tonali at Brescia. Tonali started off his Serie A career really well. Then he looked uninterested, and people thought, okay, he needs a move, just like Chiesa. But he was just the same at Milan. He was uninterested, indifferent, in a team that was really working well. So Chiesa actually ended up in the ideal environment for him, which is not something that was necessarily to be expected, because Juventus basically devoured the career of a lot of young Italian players. I mean, you think about Rugani or Bernardeschi himself just in the last few years. They were absolutely annihilated by the move to Juventus. And Chiesa just took it to another level. Now, if he's going to be thought of as better than Dybala, I think it might be the case, even though it might not be true. And here's what I mean. Dybala was absolutely great until about a year and a half ago. But what people are going to remember is how Dybala's last few months were under Juventus, because we got that fresh under our eyes. So I think it actually clouds a bit our impressions of how good Dybala was. But Dybala was actually, in my opinion, I mean, even in Serie A's opinion, he was actually better than Ronaldo in Allegri's final season. He was a Serie A MVP. So the only problem is that Dybala needs a system that works for him. I think Chiesa, in some function, can work in pretty much any system. He can work even in a 3-5-2 as a winger. He can play in a 4-3-3. He can play pretty much anywhere. Dybala, on the other hand, he showed that he needs a system like Allegri had in the past, like Sarri had. But with Ronaldo and with the team built around Ronaldo, he really, really suffers, because he doesn't know where to position himself. He ends up being too far away from the goal, in positions in which he's uncomfortable. So again, I think what's happening right now is going to cloud the image of Dybala, who was an exceptional player. And people might think that Chiesa was a better player just because they remember the ending of Dybala. Unless, of course, Allegri manages to bring the old Dybala back. But I think it's going to be really tough with Ronaldo and the team. But if Chiesa is going to be as good as Dybala, in the real sense, then Juventus fans are in for a treat, because Dybala was, again, one of the top two or three players in Serie A, in a Serie A that had more champions than it's going to have next year.
Yeah,
there's, of course,
that's a very good point.
We've just lost Donnarumma, for example. We've just lost Hakimi, and I think we're going to lose a few more before the transfer window is done. So, honestly, to just wrap up your question, I think Dybala is going to be a better player, but Chiesa is going to be remembered more fondly, because too many fans have short memories and forget about the past and only think about the present or the recent past.